say that they have a fear of going back to their home country, they're immediately detained pending a determination on their case.
We have 45 seconds. So explain what you're calling for right now.
So what we've been calling for all along is that I should be using their discretion with regards to their parole process to release her so that she can get adequate medical care and be able to live with her family who are already here.
In New York.
In New York until the challenge on her claim is completed.
And Fatima Maarouf, what do you expect to come out of this? This is a bond hearing today?
This is a bond hearing before the Dallas Immigration Court, and we're all hoping that the judge will issue a bond.
And do you know how much she will have to pay, whether she can do this?
We don't know until the judge issues the order. Her family's obviously been working hard to gather money in order to post a bond, and when we know the amount, then they will immediately post it if they have it.
Well, we will certainly continue to cover this. People should go to our website at democracynow.org, and we'll put out word today what happens in that hearing. Fatima Maarouf, attorney for Sara Beltran-Hernandez, bioethics expert Bryn Esplin, and Justin Mazzola of Amnesty International, thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 o'clock. And coming up, unfortunately, Joanne Hardesty is not going to be able to be with us this morning. So we have a program of Bradcast. That's coming up just in a minute. At 9 o'clock, Press Watch, your weekly counter-propaganda left opinion program. Fight the Empire at 9:30. Welcome scholar Stephen Cohen to discuss the allegations of Trump's Kremlin connections. Chris Andre at 10 with Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, we'll look at the wave of threats and attacks on Jewish cemeteries and community centers. Plus, an excerpt from Greg Palast's film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. At 11, Between the Covers welcomes the author of A Really Good Day as she shares her personal experiment of microdosing with LSD. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk reviews work from well-known and emerging authors. And that's because of generous donations from KBOO members. KBOO.fm is the website to go to and click donate to support this great programming. Coming up next, it's Bradcast on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon Action Plan, Immigration Rights, on Sunday, March 19th at the Concordia University Library in Portland. Oregon Action Plan is a series of events to inform and empower our community. This first event will focus on immigration in Oregon. How is what's happening on the national level affecting people in Oregon? What are organizations doing to support and protect their communities? And what can allies do to be effective and supportive? Again, that's Oregon Action Plan, Immigration Rights, on Sunday, March 19th at the Concordia University Library, 2800 Northeast Liberty Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This week on Progressive Spirit, we discuss something that is common to families. Adult children saying no thanks to their parents' faith.
Does a preacher father lose his son when his son loses his faith?
Bart Campolo talks about the book he wrote with his father, Tony Campolo, Why I Left, Why I Stayed. Conversations on Christianity between an evangelical father and his humanist son. Listen to weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/progressive spirit.
We will look back on tonight as when this new chapter of American greatness began. The time for small thinking is over. The time for trivial fights is behind us.
Yet you wish. Good luck with that, Mr. President.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Certainly isn't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake, California, up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast and 106.7 FM KSO in Cottage Grove. 92.9 FM WLRI in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui. WGRN 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. 102.9 FM WLPP in Palinville, New York. WPRR in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We're also heard streaming coast to coast and around the globe every damn day on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, and Radio Sputnik, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. And yes, as you may have guessed, today it's our special coverage of whatever the hell happened on Tuesday night in a joint session of Congress when President Trump largely managed to stick to the teleprompter. In his address to that joint session of Congress, his first such address, which is not officially a State of the Union because presidents don't give one of those until after their first year in office, I guess, but it had all the trappings of a State of the Union. The speech, as per Trump's habit, was long on nationalistic rhetoric and exaggerations, if short on actual policy details. But it seems the bar is now so low for this president that not saying something ridiculously stupid seems to suffice for a great presidential moment in history. At least if you listen to and read much of the corporate media coverage last night and today. It was a little bit different from recent State of the Union speeches, from all State of the Union speeches, actually, in that there were actually very few on the Democratic side of the aisle, literally on the Democratic side of the aisle, trying to be seen and shake the president's hand as he entered the chamber. That's unusual. It was obviously a purposeful snub by the Democrats, who usually fight for those aisle seats, even for Republican presidential addresses in Congress, at least until now. They stood, the Democrats did, when he entered the room, but they didn't much applaud. Most of the female Democratic Congress members were wearing suffragette white, a nod to voting rights and civil rights and equal rights for women. Democrats spent most of the speech sitting quietly and respectfully with neither applause nor bursts of, "You lie!" They filed very quickly out of the chamber, however. Pretty much as soon as Trump completed the address, the Democrats were out of there. Republicans, on the other hand, offered a quite warm reception to Trump throughout the entire night. They seemed quite happy, in fact, as did those who watched the speech. 78% of those who watched it, according to CNN, ORC, and their Snap poll of viewers, 78% reacted positively to the address by the otherwise wildly unpopular president. 57% of those people had a very positive reaction, according to the poll. Two-thirds of those viewers said the president had the right priorities for the country. Two-thirds. And 7 in 10 said the speech made them more optimistic about the direction of the country. Now, that said, those numbers only reflect those who had said in advance that they plan to watch the speech. So it's not actually a measure of all Americans. People who chose to watch, who choose to watch a political speech such as this one, notes CNN, tend to be more supportive of the speaker. And in this case, the pool of speech watchers was about 8 points more Republican than the population as a whole. Those speech watchers gave Trump high marks on many of his policy proposals. But it must also be noted here, as CNN actually does, and I want to make this clear because Trump is likely to cite these numbers very soon as the best numbers ever in presidential history. While 57% had a very positive reaction to the speech, those numbers actually fell below the reviews that both the Barack Obama and George W. Bush received in their initial addresses to Congress by about 10 points in each case. So, Trump's 69% approval on his policies among speech watchers That beat George W. Bush's lowest mark ever by just 2 points in his last year of his disastrous presidency. So just a bit of perspective on those numbers. The speech included a familiar laundry list of Trump lies, exaggerations, cherry-picked and misleading facts and statistics. For example, Washington Post points out in their detailed roundup of some 13 or more notable misleading and untruthful points that Trump claimed, for example, there were 94 million Americans out of the labor force. Terrible, 94 million. As if those 94 million were seeking but unable to find work. In fact, it's a claim that the paper has given a 4 Pinocchio rating in the past, since just about 7.5 million Americans are actually looking for work. So 93% of the people that Trump cited actually don't want a job. They're people who are retired or students or stay-at-home parents or disabled, etc. But, you know, 94 million Americans are out of work if you don't bother to lift the sheets and see what's actually under some of Trump's claims here. So there was a lot of those sorts of easily demonstrated deceptions throughout his entire speech, at least from my viewing. Nonetheless, reviews from Wall Street apparently were great. The Dow soared over 300 points today, closing at an all-time high over 21,000 points following the speech, as much of the corporate media were exceedingly generous to Donald Trump, I thought, describing the speech as presidential and the long-awaited Trump pivot. Front page of the Daily News today in New York, which has been no fan of Trump's, reads, Don hits reset, takes brighter tone before Congress. Brian Williams on NBC, MSNBC, called it easily the most traditional speech Trump has given in public life, the most speech-like speech, if you will. Others were not quite as easily distracted. Glenn Thrush at the New York Times said, for any other president, this would be a boring laundry list speech, but for Trump, amazing, responsible, detailed, uniting, presidential. Tim Dickinson of Rolling Stone described it as the soft bigotry of diminished expectations. Josh Greenman over at New York Daily News said the speech was better than when Trump blamed other people for a military operation gone bad and hinted that Jewish Community Center bomb threats might be false flags. And Rebecca Traister mocked the media, by saying Trump hits it out of the ballpark by reading accurately. And in the meantime, our friend Empty Wheel, Marcy Wheeler, tweeted that was a good speech. Democrats will underestimate it at their peril. Well, let's see how a few, I don't know if they call themselves Democrats, but progressives in any event, let's see how a few may or may not underestimate Trump's first address to Congress. And if we're lucky, some of the substance or lack thereof within it. Joining us today to try and make whatever sense we can of it, of course, is our own Desi Doyen. She's with us as usual. Hi, Des.
Yes,
how are you?
Yes, I am.
Barely with us as usual. I'm also happy to be joined by Gaius Publius. That's the pen name for the longtime blogger and professional writer who contributes to a number of publications, among them Digby's Hullabaloo, Down with Tyranny, Naked Capitalism, Truth Out, and Alternate. Gaius, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Does this mean that we will be quoting an anonymous source, since you use a pen name, by having you? And is that still legal under this new president, Gaius?
Well, I think I'm about to be exported myself, so you want to catch it while you can.
Oh, good. Okay, we'll take what we can get. We're also joined today by our old friend Jackie Schechner, longtime journalist, former CNN and current TV reporter, who went on to work as the National Communications Director for Healthcare for America Now, the nation's largest healthcare reform campaign during the Obama era. And she also worked for Al Gore's Climate Reality Project. Hey, welcome back to the broadcast, Jackie.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being had. All right, let's start broad here as usual before we get into some of the specifics in the bit. But let's go broad here. Hey, Jackie, I remember for a few years after the shooting of Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, when Democrats and Republicans actually sat together, they went out of their way to sit together. During State of the Union speeches, Not so much anymore, it seems. The Democrats were not playing last night, it seems.
As well they shouldn't. I mean, I'm astonished this morning how sensible people are coming out and saying that this is a pivot, this is somehow a reset. I remember Trump, everything else he's done before last night, and I didn't think the speech was anything spectacular either. I mean, to me, it was a man reading off a teleprompter, doing so without the usual onslaught of flubs, but it's the same person. I mean, Donald Trump is still Trump, and so everything he's done up until giving a speech last night that clearly somebody else wrote and he was capable of reading doesn't make him a different person. And I think being at all the least bit forgiving of anything he's done up until that point is embarrassingly naive.
Well, speaking of embarrassingly naive, for all the pretend pushback against Trump from Republicans over the past year or so, and even in recent months, pretending that they oppose him or this or on this or that, Gaius, they sure did give him a warm reception on Tuesday night, it seemed to me.
Well, I think that Trump and the Republican Party have both been outed as each other. And that's something that we haven't heard said very much, but it's absolutely true.
What does that mean? They've been outed as each other? That really they're both the same? They're not opposed at all as they've been pretending for so long?
Well, they're interlocking directorates, to use a corporate metaphor. Trump has been, during the primary, very successfully ran as, I'm not the Democratic, I'm not the Republican establishment. Just as Sanders ran, I'm not the Democratic establishment. And that brought to both of those candidates a surge of what would, in 2008, would have been Obama voters. People who were looking for change, major change in the system for any number and any variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was a lot of anecdotal evidence that in open primaries, people would come in and say, well, I'm a Trump voter, I'm a Sanders voter, which ballot do I want? So Trump has a different kind of Republican. He's got different trade policies. He wants to increase jobs. He wants to change tax structure. The Trump before the election was a different kind of Republican. And the contrast was to the Paul Ryan Republicans, who were just slash and burn.
Mm-hmm.
Jackie knows this as better than anybody, what he wants to do to health care, what he wants to do to Social Security, and all of that. Well, it turns out that they have reached an accommodation where the soft, gooey, ugly center of the Trump agenda, I should say the regime agenda, the Trump-Bannon to keep it domestic, Trump-Bannon-Pence agenda, really overlaps with the soft, gooey, ugly center of the Paul Ryan agenda. They just have to figure out how to get it past people who don't want either.
But
they are each other, and they should be identified as each other.
I think you make a good
Brad,
point.
Let me just jump in real quick. I would argue that he's not a Republican at all. I mean, I would argue he's an entertainer who likes adulation, and so he's going to go along with whatever he thinks is popular in the moment. I don't think Trump himself has much of an agenda. So I think the Republicans are hoping that they can contain him enough to push through their agenda. But I think Trump will go with, really, as they say, the last person he spoke with, and whatever he thinks is going to make him popular in the moment.
But
I don't know that ideologically he's been a lifelong Republican. I don't think he's been much of anything.
Well, no, he hasn't. But on a policy level, he's certainly singing the Republican song. So the question is Trump becoming more like the old school Republicans, or are the are the Republicans in Congress now happily moving towards Trump's position as you see it?
Jackie's making a really good point, and I'd like to just point out that that's differentiating Trump the person from the Trump administration policy, as you say, Brad. And both are valid discussions, but Jackie's right about Trump the person. The nation is stuck with Trump the policy engine, and Trump the person's job will be to advance that policy engine so that he gets the most ego points he can get. Because I think that's what he plays for.
All right, before we get to some of those items in that policy engine, Trump opened with a single paragraph last night about the recent and unprecedented wave of bomb threats against Jewish community centers across the country. And what I believe is his very first and only acknowledgement, to my knowledge, So far, of the triple shooting last week in Olathe, Kansas, by a man who allegedly shouted, "Get out of my country," before shooting two Indian men here on legal work visas, who the shooter thought was apparently thought they were Iranian. Wrapped into that same single paragraph was a recognition of the final day of Black History Month.
Recent threats targeting Jewish community centers and vandalism of Jewish cemeteries, as well as last week's shooting in Kansas City, remind us that while we may be a nation divided on policies, we are a country that stands united in condemning hate and evil in all of its very ugly forms.
And that was sort of the one nod, the one thing that he had to say about that before moving on. Jackie Schechner, I noticed on the Twitters last night during the speech, you flatly rejected that commentary. You did not accept those. You were not moved or impressed by that, by those words.
No, I mean, to me, actions speak louder than days and weeks late words. He's done and said absolutely nothing in the moment. It's been evidenced by his behavior and his campaign and his administration's behavior that this stuff doesn't mean anything to them. And I think that if you come out in a speech and you grant it some lip service because you think it's the appropriate thing to do in the moment, even though you've never found it appropriate before, it means very little, if anything, at all. I found it to be embarrassingly sycophantic, and I don't think that they've demonstrated anything beyond putting some sentences together and having Trump read them. And it's offensive. And it's offensive, frankly, to lump all of it in together with the end of Black History Month, because I don't think that he cares much about minorities either.
Gaius Publius, your thoughts, too little, too late, or just what needed to be done here before moving on?
I'm looking at the optics. Too little, too late, of course. But we all knew that Trump had this meanness about him that he constantly showed during the campaign, and we don't have any sign that he's lost it. What he's really done is given himself a paint job, and he's hoping, and he did that throughout the speech, by the way. I was lightly tweeting mm-hmm. all of the cases where Trump was paying lip service, as Jackie says, to minorities of various types. He pointed a number of them out in the gallery, in the audience, so to speak, and I think he was just really trying to cover himself with, "I'm not a racist, I'm not a sexist." There were a lot of women that were pointed out. That kind of person as a cover for what really lurked beneath, which was a lot of the policy stuff. So I even found a couple of places where he would switch almost mid-sentence between saying something nice and then saying something incredibly horrible that was contradictory to the thing that he said that was nice, hoping that people would somehow merge the two together.
You had referred to the identity politics triangulation that you said was deliberate that Trump was doing last night. Is that what you're referring to? Actually, I should say, what does that mean? Deliberate identity politics triangulation.
Well, the deliberate part comes from the fact that it was done constantly. So if you see a football team running the same play, sorry about the sports metaphor, folks. If you see a football team running the same play 30 times in all four quarters, you suspect that that's part of the playbook. This is not an improvisation. The play that they ran was to try to reposition the Trump team and the Trump administration and Republicans, because Republicans have that meanness about them also. They try to position themselves as friend of blacks, friends of Mexicans, friend of immigrants, friend of Muslims, friend of this, friend of that, immediately before talking about red meat policy that was designed to be against those people, that he would present the policy in a way that doesn't say, the people I just praised, I'm going to kick in the shins. He just praised the people mm-hmm. and then showed the policy that would kick you them in the shins if he explained it a little more.
And apparently that worked.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say, that this obviously works for them to couch what they're saying in the nice-sounding words that everybody falls for, because the people that they're intended for will fall for them. That's, you know, Republicans in Congress. That's, you know, specifically Republicans and folks who consider themselves to be conservatives out in America who voted for Trump. They'll think, oh, see, he said all the right things, therefore we don't have to worry about racism anymore. It's over. And it works on the media, because clearly today they've been over and over and over again about how presidential he looked without actually looking at the fact that everything he said was either standard Republican boilerplate or seriously scary authoritarianism.
And I want to...
I'm glad you pointed out the media, Jackie, because that's exactly right. He's not only playing to his base, he's also playing to the media, because the media is going to position him.
Yes,
that's,
I mean, actually, this is Desi, but
strategy.
Yes.
Exactly right.
Well, that was Desi. Yeah, that was Desi. But I will glom on just a little bit with this, is that, you know, I think what's happened with the media landscape is that instead of coming out from the beginning and pointing out the absurdities of Trump, his campaign, and his tactics and the rhetoric, they've tried to somehow normalize it by having people on who support him, who I don't think deep down most of them actually believe the stuff that they're supporting, because they know he's ridiculous. I mean, I had a joke about the bingo card the following morning was going to be either he didn't say that, or that's not what he meant, or that's not what was in his heart, or his followers knew what he meant. It's the rhetoric that follows up these sorts of events where people try to explain away what Trump actually said. And the media has gotten into this this habit and routine now of attempting to normalize and make regular the craziness that is Trump. And so I think when you look at something like happened last night, it's more of the same in that vein of trying to say, well, he was presidential, when in fact he said very little that was more than a third grade reading level off of a note card. Well, there was nothing there that felt or sounded presidential to me at all.
Well, and we got to get to a break here in a moment. We'll come back with some actual substance of the things that he did say. But I mean this as a serious question right now. And this, I think, even applies to other presidents, not just Donald Trump. But all of this raises the question, what's more important now, ultimately, to American presidencies? Is it substance or is it style? Because, you know, Jackie, your old colleagues at CNN on air last night, I mean, they were just doing backflips to declare the speech a triumphant moment for Trump. Even though he just, you know, was reading off of a teleprompter, and he, you know, spent the last I don't know how many months describing CNN as fake news. But ultimately, that's what the viewers are hearing. That's what they're watching. And, you know, it's a serious question. If a president can come up with the style, ultimately, is that now enough in these United States?
Unfortunately, it's become enough for the electorate that gave Trump the Oval Office, but it shouldn't be. I mean, Obama had style and substance. And I think that I'm hoping that there will be some sort of backlash in terms of coming back around to substance again, because this is embarrassing. It's embarrassing for us as a country. It's embarrassing for us internationally. I cringe when I hear his voice. I cower when he, you know, I see him as a representation of the United States, because it's not who we are. And I think anybody who has any sense sees a naked emperor, and when we continue to see the naked emperor. So I hope that we get back to the point where we mandate just as a society that whoever leads us has some substance to them, because this is, I hope this is as low as it can go. I really do.
Well, one hopes, yes, that it is as low as it can go. But, you know, clearly it is a strategy that actually works. I mean, basically the number of lies that Trump dispensed in that speech, the media is not going to take as much time in debunking them. Clearly they've already spent most of the time talking about the tone instead of the substance. So I think we have a long road to walk on that one, getting substance back.
We will continue to walk that long road after this quick break. Our special coverage of the joint session, the address to the joint session of Congress by Donald Trump on Tuesday, with my guest Jackie Schechner and Gaius Publius, and of course Desi Doyen. Much more of that straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is the Bradcast.
In 2016, the earth shifted beneath our feet. The rebellion started as a quiet protest spoken by families of all colors and creeds, families who just wanted a fair shot for their children and a fair hearing for their concerns.
I feel the earth move under my feet. Yep. I feel the sky tumbling down.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com covering the address, Donald Trump's address to the joint session of Congress on Tuesday. With my guests, Jackie Schechner and Gaius Publius. The big moment in last night's presidential address, it seems, at least the one that so many are now talking about the following day, was that long, long, really long ovation, one that Trump extended with ad-libs several times for the widow of a Navy SEAL, Ryan Owens, who was killed in Yemen in a disastrous attack. The first such a ground attack authorized by Donald Trump. Van Jones over on CNN said in that moment that Trump became president. But Gaius Publius, you brought an observation from Brandon Friedman, no relation. He's a former government official, that the media seemed to see that moment very differently than many veterans apparently did.
Yes, and not just veterans, but civilians, in the sense that they're not pro, they're not media pros. They're not in the biz. So I marked a couple of, he did some side-by-side Twitter comments. First from Katie Turr, what the president did with Owens' widow was capital P presidential, single most extraordinary moment I've seen.
She's from NBC. Yeah, go ahead.
And she, you pointed out the Van Jones comment. Mm-hmm. Dan Merica of CNN said, Navy SEAL's widow provides emotional high point in Trump's speech. You could call that descriptive, but it's a little glorifying as well. And contrast to that with just ordinary people. Bill Putnam photo tweets, no, Van Jones, he exploited her and her family's grief. Max Rosenthal, get the camera off this poor woman, with a swear word following. And finally, Chris Shannon, whose picture makes him look like a veteran, with respect to using widow of Navy SEAL as a political prop, quote, he became president in that moment, you can go bleep yourself, Van. Mm. I think there's a real divide in the nation about this president, and that divide is not reflected, as we've said in the last segment, in the media. And I have to say, part of the reason for that is the media has been softened up. I mean, I think they've been softened up not only by Trump in the newsrooms in the media, but I think they've also been softened up by their own CEO class, their owner class, who will have business before Donald Trump, and that business will very much want it to go forward. People at CNN and places like that are really being triangulated, whatever their intentions need to be, and we're not going to get much help from them, I don't think.
Well, this was, Republicans and Democrats alike in that chamber going on and on. It felt very exploitative, frankly, to me, and I think that would be true even if the mission hadn't been, which lost a Navy SEAL, a U.S. helicopter. They killed about 20 women and children, including an American-born child. Even if that hadn't been approved by Trump himself, it seemed extraordinarily exploitative and uncomfortable and almost surreal to me. Jackie,
I think we need to be careful. Yeah, I just want to be careful here. Something to just note. I don't want the tone of any of this conversation to insinuate that his widow was being used in a way that she hadn't consented to.
I agree with you on that, yes.
Because, Mary Catherine Hammett put something out about this that got a lot of play on Twitter. And I will point out that Mary Catherine, unfortunately, lost her own husband recently. Mm. And so I think that you can't speak to why someone would choose to participate. I originally had the same thought, like, gosh, leave this poor woman alone. And then I didn't put anything out to that effect because I realized that it was not my place to pass judgment on what made her feel comfortable. And there may have been a moment in there that she needed to be acknowledged or to have her husband's loss acknowledged. I just want to be careful not to say that she was being used and to insinuate that she was somehow victimized. What I do want to point out is that in the information we have surrounding how the decision was made to to go forth with that raid, that it does seem that President Trump, and I use those two words together in a way that really bothers me, yes. But he made the decision over dinner. It seems very casual. There's some insinuation that he was mm-hmm. tweeting about other things while it was happening, that he couldn't be bothered to go to the Situation Room, that it was not well planned, that the loss could have been avoided had it not been carried out. I mean, there are all of these extenuating circumstances that we can point to as to why this seemed like a propaganda moment. But I just want to be careful to not insinuate that this is a weak woman that's somehow being used against her will, because there may be very real reasons why she chose to participate. And I just don't want to diminish those.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jackie, that we should respect her choice to be a part of the that, and I'm sure that was very important for her. But I think the point that you bring up is where the real nub of this is that the media has then latched on to what was a very moving moment, clearly, but has then ignored all the circumstances, as you mentioned, that
Correct.
Led up to
Correct.
That. So it's an excellent deflection strategy, is what it has turned out
Correct.
To be.
And God knows, yeah. to be clear, I don't blame her. I don't blame, you know, her for anything at all. I'm talking about the way that Trump was milking that moment, and that seemed very troubling to me. Guys?
Yes, and I agree with what Jackie said, but I also want to look at what, this is a brilliant move by the Trump team to recapture the narrative around that raid. I mean, the narrative around that raid was terrible prior to this. And the team, have managed to completely reposition themselves and allow the media to reposition him as well in terms of how that story gets told.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have. And that's what the media does. They allow they're easily manipulated. Speaking of easily manipulated, let's move on to some of the substance here. The Affordable Care Act, of course, or Obamacare, the name that I know still drives Jackie Schechner crazy when I use it.
Insane.
I know, but it's a short drive for you, Jackie. That got, of course, quite of a bit of attention last night in the wake of Republicans, frankly, having very difficult time trying to figure out how to repeal and replace a health care plan that has now offered insurance and or medical coverage to some 22 million more Americans than before Obamacare was created. Whatever you think of Obamacare, there are now some 20 million Americans that now have at least access to health care that did not have it before. Here's Trump speaking about the need to immediately, or as soon as possible anyway, repeal and replace this disastrous Obamacare.
I am also calling on this Congress to repeal and replace Obamacare with reforms that expand choice, increase access, lower costs, and at the same time provide better health care. Mandating every American to buy government-approved health insurance was never the right solution for our country. The way to make health insurance available to everyone is to lower the cost of health insurance, and that is what we are going to do. Obamacare premiums nationwide have increased by double and triple digits. One-third of the counties have only one insurer, and they're losing them fast. They are losing them so fast. They're leaving. And many Americans have no choice at all. There's no choice left. Remember, when you were told that you could keep your doctor and keep your plan, we now know that all of those promises have been totally broken. Obamacare is collapsing, and we must act decisively to protect all Americans.
Okay, Jackie Schechner, I suspect we couldn't have teed up a softer ball for you here as a many years as a healthcare reformer during the Obama era. But there's your smorgasbord. Take your pick from those comments.
Yeah, good luck with that, right? You want less expensive coverage.
Right.
You want no mandate. You want more access. It's not doable. I mean, I would like $1 million to fall from the sky. It's not going to happen. The reason why the mandate is in place is because if you want insurers to be required to cover everybody, which means no more pre-existing condition exclusions, you got to get everybody in the pool. The insurance industry is about making the most money possible for its shareholders. They're businesses, and that's what they're required by law to do. They're not required to make sure you get healthy. They're not required to make sure that you have good access to good care. They're required to make as much money as possible for the people that are on their board. So when you talk about having a mandate, that's what the insurance industry agreed to in order to drop the pre-existing conditions thing. If you want that to continue, you got to convince the insurance industry that they're going to continue to make money. And there's no way to do that without requiring that everybody get in the pool, that everybody's covered, because you need to be able to cover healthy people and sick people all together, or it doesn't mitigate their risk.
Trump.
And then at the same
No, go ahead.
No, and then at the same time, you talk about like more access, lower price. I don't know how you plan to do that, because the insurance companies are going to charge what they want to charge. They have monopolies. They're not competing for your business. They're competing to see what the market will bear, because unfortunately in this country, you need to have access to health insurance in order to get access to health care. And they know that. They're the gatekeepers. So they're not going to lower their prices to make a better deal for you. They're going to raise their prices together in collaboration to see how much money they can possibly make. So, you know, Trump talks about being this great deal maker. Let him sit down with the insurance industry, who funds much of Congress, by the way, and figure out how to get everybody covered and with lower prices, with great care, and not require everybody to buy some product.
Let me see how good you've gotten at this, Jackie. I've got Trump came up with five points concerning whatever reform plan, replace and reform plan they imagine they're going to come up with. Let me get your very quick response to each of them. He talked about those with pre-existing conditions must still have access to health care and a stable transition from the exchanges.
Well, access is not necessarily something I can afford. I mean, I can have access, as Bernie Sanders would say, I have access to a mansion. It doesn't mean I can afford it.
All right.
Access is not the same thing as affordability.
Good, quick answer. Healthcare, health savings accounts. What's that about? They're talking about that a lot.
Oh, these are my favorite. You got a little extra money that you can put aside into a tax shelter just in case you get sick. I mean, that's what that is, assuming that everybody's got money that they can put aside for the rainy day when they may get sick and need it, and assuming you have enough to cover whatever that illness or ailment happens to be, and they're attached to high deductible plans.
All right, give.
So it's essentially saying, here's a little extra money. You have a high deductible. All that payment for health care is going to come out of your pocket. It's just going to sit in like a tax-free account for a while.
Give governors resources they need to make sure no one is left out. What the hell is he talking about there?
My guess is they're trying to do something with Medicaid. But we've proven over the years that block grants don't work, that it's not enough money to cover people who need Medicaid in certain states. I think it's their language to try to figure out what to do about Medicaid and Medicaid expansion. But basically, there's not enough money to go around. So nothing like that's actually going
to
work.
Let me toss this one to Gaius. Number four here was the unnecessary costs and high prices of drugs. I think he pointed to Bernie Sanders on that as he mentioned that. But how will they possibly lower costs, Gaius?
Well, they first have to want to. But the way you lower costs in the drug industry is pretty obvious. You can do what they do in Europe and institute price controls, which is what European single-payer type policies tend to do in various flavors in various countries. There's upper limits to prices that providers can charge. In the United States, if you want to do it in a competitive situation, let the government be the largest negotiator of drug prices for all government, federal government purchases, and let them negotiate the price the way you, if you're the volume buyer of cars in your town, you've got 90% of the market. You can negotiate the best price available from the people who are going to sell to you.
But
so let's negotiate those prices. The third way, by the way, is drug importation from Canada, which creates natural competition.
But haven't Republicans in Congress and Democrats in Congress over and over again, pretty much other than Bernie Sanders, actually, let me say, other than Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, haven't those Republicans and those Democrats just resisted time and time again the idea that the government should be negotiating the price of drugs and allowing import and so forth?
That's,
Say that again. What'd you say, Jack?
I said, have you met pharma? I mean, we have a pharmaceutical lobby that's incredibly powerful. There's absolutely no way they're going to be able to get any of that done unless they get pharma on board, and they're not going to.
Exactly. And finally, the fifth point here was purchase health insurance across state lines. Allow that to be done. Jackie, I think I've asked you probably every time you've been on this show, but I guess it bears repeating. What's wrong with that plan? Hey, just let people purchase their insurance from a different state.
Well, there's a couple of reasons behind it. One is that consumer protections in this country are state-based. So if you get rid of state lines, all of the insurance companies are going to set up in the states with the laxest regulations, mm-hmm. like your credit card company set up in Delaware. So you're going to end up having cut consumer protections. The thing is, if you look at the way our insurance market works, networks are regional. So if you end up buying a policy, let's say it's a cheaper policy in Nevada, it doesn't necessarily guarantee that any of your doctors in California would be covered. And then you end up having really high out-of-network costs. And also cost of living is different, right? So you can buy a cheap plan in Iowa that's not going to cover anything in a city that has a higher cost of living, or a state, rather, that has a higher cost of living. So there's a lot that would have to be done in order for that to be beneficial, but just all of a sudden letting that happen is not the competitive advantage that people assume it's going to be.
We've got to move ahead here. There's so much to cover. Trump talked about regulations. He talked about coal jobs. He talked about pipelines. Gaius and maybe Desi Doyen, I'll set up some softballs for you guys here with this comment when Trump talked about, somehow restoring coal jobs. He didn't tell us how that was going to happen. And clearing the way for the completion of the Dakota Access and Keystone XL oil pipelines.
We're imposing a new rule which mandates that for every one new regulation, two old regulations must be eliminated. We're going to stop the regulations that threaten the future and livelihood of our great coal miners. We have cleared the way for the construction of the Keystone and Dakota Access pipelines, thereby creating tens of thousands of jobs. And I've issued a new directive that new American pipelines be made with American steel.
Okay, Gaius Publius, take your pick. There's a smorgasbord for you. Where do you even start with that?
The lack of wanting to remove regulations is both a Republican wet dream and, to some extent, if you look at the New Dems and the Third Way Democrats, a Democratic wet dream as well. But also, with respect to Trump, I think that's a land developer's wet dream. This is a place where he does have actual policy preferences. So there's a huge intersection there. Wanting to get rid of regulations basically says, allow the largest predators in the forest to eat as much food as they want and take away any possibility of the prey to protect themselves. So he's going to do that all sorts of ways. As far as coal, you mentioned coal.
Mm-hmm.
Those coal jobs aren't coming back, and the reason they're not coming back is because coal, like a lot of industries, is being very highly mechanized. So he can actually probably... I don't know if he can. I'm picking a number out of my hat here. Triple the number of jobs, triple the amount of sales, mm-hmm. coal sales in the world. I think there's a lot of overseas market for coal if you can get it to a port, which is a problem for a lot of localities. But let's say you could sell as much coal as you could dig, including on federal lands. You probably don't triple the workforce doing that. You might add a tenth or so of the workforce, again, guessing at the numbers. That's a very highly mechanized industry. Those jobs are not coming back.
How long can Republicans continue to say that we're going to bring the coal jobs back before people in coal country realize they are lying and abandon them? I mean, they can only blame Obama's war on coal, which didn't really happen, but they can only blame Obama's war on coal and the EPA for so long. Are they going to figure that out, guys?
Yes, they are at some point. And I want to step back because this is one instance of really one of the major arcs of this presidency, which is he has made an awful lot of populist promises that he cannot possibly keep. And at some point, that's going to catch up with him.
I don't know when and I don't know how. I think Jeff Beauregard Sessions is going to help with that, with his busting heads on the pipeline protesters, for example. He's going to help with that when it comes to for all of his Black History Month rhetoric. As soon as the Black Lives Matter protests start up again, and as soon as these newly enabled militarized cops that Trump loves to stand in front of, the beefy millions of people who police our neighborhoods, those people are going to feel newly empowered to crack heads and newly bulletproof, newly invulnerable, bulletproof metaphorically, but newly invulnerable to prosecution and blame. I think that we're headed for a real kind of rolling civil war in this country, and I think that he's trying to keep this at bay as long as he possibly can, as are the Republicans. But at some point, especially if we get 8 years of Republicans, this ship is going to hit the side of the harbor and break. And I don't know where it's going to happen, but all of these issues are instances of the ways that could happen.
Well, I certainly hope you're right, that eventually those
who support... I hope he's wrong, that it's not a rolling civil war.
Not the rolling civil war part. Sorry, the part about where eventually it seems that those who support him and who got him elected will eventually catch on to the fact that all of the stuff he says he cannot follow through on. But my fear is that they actually won't, because fantasy sells very well among the American public, and especially in coal country, because... I think that they know and they have access to the information that shows that coal is not going to come back, especially when it comes to its competition with natural gas, which has overtaken most of the market. And I just don't see that that's necessarily going to happen as soon as we would need it to, especially since they're cheering the removal and repeal of all of these clean water regulations that were actually supposed to keep protecting the water in coal country. I mean, those people's water, they just voted for somebody to pollute their water again. So I see that tension, and I wonder if there is a way for it to play out.
Well, I would do a yes bet to that, Desi, that yes, at the change election in 2008, which is after the crash that we never recovered from, is the change election of 2016. None of that need for change in the country is going to go away. Now, will the country be, in essence, destroyed by this manic wrecking crew that's in government now, prior to people rising up? That's a race. I don't know who's going to win that race. Will the rise up be something anybody wants to live through? Nobody wants to live in a country with a civil war. So, Brad, I would agree with you completely there. We shouldn't have to do this to get the country that we need to be peaceful and happy in. But it looks like that may be headed that way.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll talk about the disastrous next election coming up, because I want to get all three of your thoughts on the direction of the Democratic Party, on the Democratic response to that speech last night. And maybe if we have time, the election over the weekend of the new DNC chair. Take a quick break, and we'll be back with more of our special coverage of whatever the hell happened in Congress last night, with Donald Trump's first address to a joint session, with our guests Jackie Schechner, Gaius Publius, Desi Doyen, and myself, Brad Friedman. You're listening to The Bradcast. Don't touch that dial.
Dying industries will come roaring back to life. Heroic veterans will get the care they so desperately need. Our military will be given the resources. Crumbling infrastructure will be replaced. And our neglected inner cities will see a rebirth of hope, safety, and opportunity. In fact, our children will grow up in a nation of miracles.
Wonder of wonders, miracle of miracles, God took a Daniel once again.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We've got just a few minutes with our coverage of Donald Trump's address to a joint session of Congress that was not a State of the Union for some reason or another, but sure as hell looked and smelled like one. Speaking of smells, no, that's not the right way to put this. Steve Beshear, the former governor, Kentucky governor, actually speaking of coal country, the former Kentucky governor Steve Beshear gave the Democratic response to Trump's address. I don't have time to play much of substance, but it started this way.
I'm a proud Democrat, but first and foremost, I'm a proud Republican. and Democrat and mostly American.
What?
And like many of you, I am worried about the future of this nation.
Okay, I don't know exactly what he meant there, but I actually thought that Bashir gave one of the most effective responses that I recall seeing. But there have been a lot of folks criticizing Democrats for not using a rising star like California Senator Kamala Harris or even a Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, since he's the expected to be the face of Democratic opposition. Let me very quickly go around the table here and get the thoughts from Jackie Schechner and Gaius Publius. I thought he did well, but a lot of people were critical. Jackie, what do you think?
You know, I don't think that sort of thing matters that much. Mm-hmm. I think what's going to matter here on out is what the Democratic Party does to fight back against the Trump agenda. I mean, I really, at this point, the Democrats need to put on a little bit of their Republican fighting spirit, and maybe that's what he meant, but they need to put it on, and they need to band together, and they need to fight for the things that they believe in. And, you know, we tend to be a soft, big tent, everybody come on in party. I think now's the time to really stand up for what we believe in and for working class Americans and for environmental regulation and health care and all of those good things. And that means getting tough.
Gaius, is that what they were trying to do, put up a sort of a conservative Democrat to reach out to Trump, to Trump voters? Or were they ducking by, oh, just get the old retired guy, throw him up there while Democrats figure out what the hell to do?
I see this through the lens of the same lens that I saw the DNC chair fight that just recently concluded. That is, this is the two wings of the Democratic Party, the Sanders wing slash Warren wing slash et cetera, Merkley wing, versus the centrist wing, the old guard, trying to jockey each other for power. Who's going to be the face of the resistance? Who's going to benefit from being the resistance to Trump? And in this instance, as I see it, the centrist wing won. Why wasn't Warren the spokesperson? Why wasn't Sanders the spokesperson?
I agree.
Good question. Again, nothing against what Bashir did. He did fine. But where's the real resistance going to come from? Since you brought it up there, Gaius, very quickly, your thoughts on the weekend election. We haven't talked about it. I haven't gotten to talk about it on this show. The DNC chair, former labor secretary, former head of the DOJ Civil Rights Unit, Tom Perez. He was endorsed by Obama. He edged out the Bernie Sanders endorsed Keith Ellison. Is that another sign that the centrists are winning in the Democratic Party?
Yes. To put it very briefly, 3 points. One, it's even though the candidates might have been more or less identical on many issues, it mattered very, very much to the Obama slash Clinton wing of the party to defeat these people that Obama himself whipped for Perez. The optics for low-information Sanders voters, people who get their news from headlines and go on with their lives, the optics is just terrible. So Dem exit took a bit of a jump as a result of this. And finally, on the substance, there are real many issues here. Do you want consultants sitting on the DNC committee? Do you want lobbyists sitting on the DNC? Or do you want to go back to the Obama era where you don't take money from lobbyists and consultants? They're clearly establishing themselves as we're as far as money goes, we're doing business the same way we did under Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Jackie Schechner, did Democrats make a mistake by choosing Tom Perez as you see it?
I think they make a mistake every time that they reinforce the status quo. I just think our country is heading in a different direction, and I think you need to fight fire with fire. And I think people are over the establishment. I think that we need to embrace the movement that's happening, and I think it needs to be fierce on the left, the same way it's forceful on the right.
Well stated. Des, you got a final thought?
Yeah, just the I think that Trump and the Republicans, Trump especially, has stolen the economic populism argument from Democrats, the centrist corporatist Democrats, while they slept, and that's where they need to focus, and I don't know that they know that yet.
You'd think this would have woken them up by now, but apparently not. So this is going to take a while. I got to get out here. We're running late. Thank you, both of you guys, very, very much. Jackie Schechner can find your work at jackieschechner.com and follow her and share her and harass her on the Twitters at Jackie at Jackie Schechner. You'll figure out how to spell it, especially if you can spell Gaius Publius. You can find him at gaiuspublius.tumblr.com. Tumblr.com. He also tweets as Gaius_Publius. Hey, thanks to both of you guys.
A pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure.
Greatly appreciated. Also, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's broadcast, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. You can also drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. You can find, follow, share, and harass me on the Twitters and the Facebooks at The Brad Blog. My thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to make sure we can continue doing what we struggle to do every day here on your public airwaves. That is greatly appreciated as well. All right, that's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Good morning. It's 8:59, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. The weather, cloudy today. Rain likely mainly after 4 o'clock with a high around 59. Coming up next, Teresa Mitchell is ready for Press Watch, your weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program, coming up in just about 1 minute. At 9:30, Fight the Empire welcomes scholar Stephen Cohen to discuss the allegations of Trump's Kremlin connections. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, on Flash Points, we'll look at the wave of threats and attacks on Jewish cemeteries and community centers, plus an excerpt from Greg Palast's film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. At 11 on Between the Covers, we welcome the author of A Really Good Day, and she shares her personal experiment of microdosing with LSD. And at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk. Reviews work from well-known and emerging authors. And all of that is thanks to KBOO members because of your generous support. And if you'd like to get on that team, go to kboo.fm and click on donate. It's 9 o'clock.
Tune into KBOO Wednesday, March 8th for International Women's Day.
We'll be celebrating all day long with special programming focusing on feminism, intersectionality, gender illusions,
and women in jazz, reggae, punk, and metal,
and so much more. That's International Women's Day, 24 hours of programming by women-identified folks for you.
Here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly